And good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio, science and technology that's accessible, educational, and fun. I'm John Wells here with Jack Rubin, who is my guest co-host. Jack, good morning.
Good morning, John. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Great to have you with us today.
Thank you.
Our first guest this morning, Lee Billings. He's the space and physics editor at Scientific American. He's going to take us through the details of this week's SpaceX Falcon Heavy launch, and also landing, and also sports car that is heading towards the asteroid belt. If you missed any of this on Monday, tune in now, because this will blow your mind.
It will. And I'm Jack Rubin. I'm sitting in for Lynn Ware Peake. Our second guest is NASA scientist Dr. Compton Tucker, who will talk about how the space age met the dinosaur age at NASA's Goddard Space Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. Stay with us and find out about the clash between these two worlds.
And finally, Andy Hitchin. He's an engineer at Armada Skis here in Park City. He's going to bring us up to date on the science behind the making of Armada Skis. From side cut to turn initiation, rocker, weight, and more, this is the behind-the-scenes look at how designs are made and engineering of the Armada Ski. These three guests, plus today's cool story, when we return, you're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Whitney Wall from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain hosts winter events throughout the season, including Snowfest, the annual Torchlight Parade, New Year's Eve celebration, Spring Groove, and more. More information about all the events happening at Park City Mountain this winter can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. Elon Musk is at it again. This week on Tuesday, the SpaceX Falcon Heavy was launched from Cape Canaveral. If you watch the videos of the launch and then the subsequent return to ground of the two side boosters, well, you know what an unprecedented event this was. If you've seen Musk's spaceman and the red Tesla Roadster now heading towards Mars, well, it may have left you with a few questions. Joining us to take us through the launch is Lee Billings, space and physics editor at Scientific American. Lee, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, it's good to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. It was such an exciting launch. And, you know, to be a viable commercial company that successfully launches rockets into space is really a big deal. But add to that the title of a lander of rockets and then propel a red roadster towards the asteroid belt. I mean, this is really spectacular, isn't it?
It is pretty phenomenal, yeah. It seems like Elon Musk kind of checks all the boxes for James Bond-style supervillain. He's running a company, a rocket launch company. He's running another company to bore big holes under California for rapid transit. He's running another company trying to revolutionize automotives with Tesla. So he's kind of firing on all cylinders here, looking towards the future. And, of course, he wants to colonize Mars, too, which is a big part of his push with SpaceX.
He wants to be the first man to die on Mars.
As long as he's not dying on landing, I think, as the quip goes, yeah.
Do you think Tony Stark needs to pick up his game? Because I think that Elon has eclipsed him.
A little bit, yeah. You know, of course, we haven't seen a full-on Iron Man suit on Elon yet, but maybe that's coming. You know, you did notice if you watched the live stream of the Starman mannequin in the Roadster that he's wearing a SpaceX-designed spacesuit, which is what their crews will probably wear whenever they go to Mars or the Moon or wherever those huge rockets take them.
Hey, Lee, this is Jack Rubin. Thanks for joining us this morning. You know, it's pretty interesting to take a look at this rocket. It's obviously extremely viable from a commercial perspective, and this idea of putting a car in there and a guy in a suit, a few other things, sort of no lack of opportunity to try to get per unit attention to go along with the technological innovation. Pretty clever stuff, I think.
Yeah. It is definitely probably the best cross-promotional act in history, maybe. How can you really beat the midnight cherry red roadster gliding away from Earth en route to the asteroid belt as an advertisement for Tesla? It's phenomenal. Just to give your listeners a little more context, this Falcon Heavy rocket, which is now the most powerful rocket in the world, it's more than twice as powerful as its competitor, the Delta IV Heavy rocket. It is commercially useful. It's good for launching, in particular, very large payloads to geosynchronous orbits high above the Earth. Lots of military and communication satellites want to be there. That said, this is almost it's an interesting situation we're getting into, where SpaceX is almost a victim of its own success here, because its smaller rocket, the Falcon 9 rocket, has gotten so good, and it also is so powerful that there's a limited need right now for Falcon Heavy. So a lot of industry insiders are looking at this thing and saying, hey, this is a really cool capability, but heck, are there enough customers that are going to be able to use it? And SpaceX, of course, insists that there are, but I think that's the big question coming up immediately, is how many people will actually line up to use this thing, despite its revolutionary capabilities and cost.
Well, don't you think the driver is its efficiency? It seems to be, a tenth of the cost of the government version of a similar kind of vehicle.
Exactly. The tension against that is that payloads, by and large, aren't growing larger. We're getting better and better at making things smaller and smaller and more robust. Think about the iPhone that you have in your pocket probably right now, or your computer. Those same sorts of miniaturization pushes are taking place in other aspects of technology as well. And a lot of those things feed into how big of a satellite is, for instance. So there's not necessarily a huge demand immediately right now for the immense capabilities of the Falcon Heavy, but that could change very quickly because as you said, it's so cheap. It's less than a quarter of the cost of its nearest competitor, which can again lift half as much. People are probably going to get creative with thinking about how to use it, and of course, scientists are wild about what the Falcon Heavy could do. You could send a probe about seven times larger, heavier than New Horizons, the thing that went to Pluto. You could send something else to Pluto that's seven times heavier, really fast. You could send things to the moons of Jupiter and look for life there. You could launch huge space telescopes, all kinds of stuff. And, of course, maybe land people on Mars someday.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Lee Billings. He's the space and physics editor at Scientific American. He's just written a fascinating article on Monday's launch. Lee, for those folks that may have missed some of the details, why don't you just take us through sort of a thumbnail sketch of what occurred on Monday?
Sure. So what happened on Monday is the Falcon Heavy launched. This is, as I mentioned, the largest and most powerful rocket currently operational, still dwarfed by the Saturn V rocket from the 1960s and 70s that took astronauts to the moon, and it had a test launch. So the key parts that we were looking at in the test launch were obviously, I think Elon said he gave it a 50-50 chance of success, where success was being defined as the rocket just not blowing up and damaging the launch pad. So we were looking for that. It did that. And it launched this payload onto a high orbit that would eventually take it out past Mars into the asteroid belt. And this payload was Elon's Roadster, his Tesla Roadster, containing a mannequin dressed in a spacesuit called Starman that will probably be floating out there for certainly millions of years. And the other thing that was very interesting, which I think you referenced at the beginning of the program, was that we were also looking for the three components of the Falcon Heavy. It's three boosters altogether, two side boosters and a central booster. They were all going to fly back to Earth to land safely, where they could then be potentially reused and refurbished. And that's a key part of SpaceX's model. That's how it's trying to drive launch costs so low, by reusing these components. Unfortunately, when they came back to Earth, two of the boosters landed flawlessly on land right near the launch pad. That was an amazing sight to see. You may have seen it on the video, them both coming down in synchrony. It's beautiful. Looks like a vision from science fiction, but it's real. Unfortunately, the central booster, however, which had to bleed off more speed, was going to be landing in the ocean on a robotic barge. And it, I think, came in about 100 meters off course. That's because it's two of its three engines that were supposed to guide it down gently didn't work. They probably didn't have enough fuel left from the initial boost. And so it crashed into the ocean, I think, at about 300 miles per hour or something like that. made a pretty big splash that actually also damaged the robotic barge. But again, you know, we have to remember that this isn't necessarily shouldn't be seen as a failure. The rocket launched, delivered a payload to space. It was the first launch ever of this thing. So all in all, it was really a very, very, very successful test, and it really promises a bright future, I think, for the company.
So two out of three isn't bad, right?
That's right.
got two bits back. And that is part of the efficiency. And, you know, Tesla is known as a company that's eco-friendly. You later on in your article raised the issue of what's going to happen to the car. You know, it's going to float around in space. And the idea of it not being sterile, not being sterilized before being launched was something that was kind of interesting to me. Could you just tell us a little bit about where that car might go and what might happen to it?
Yeah, so a couple of things there. Let's start just really quickly with the notion of sterilization. The reason why that's important is because NASA and other space agencies that can send spacecraft to other planets have to worry about this thing called planetary protection, which is the notion that, hey, we don't necessarily want to import our Earth-bound or, you know, our earthly microbes to these pristine environments, even though the microbes may not be able to live there. And in the same way, even though this is a little more science fiction, we don't have to worry about it as much probably, we don't want to bring any little green men, you know, little green microbes back with us back into Earth if we're returning samples or something. And that this is really a sensitive issue in particular for Mars, because Mars is really the most Earth-like and habitable place that we know in the solar system outside of Earth itself. Some of the conditions that exist on the Mars surface or near subsurface that we know about could conceivably support viable colonies of microbes. So if that's why you want to sterilize your spacecraft that are going to be going anywhere near Mars, just so that in the future, if we are looking for life there, whether it's people landing there somehow or robots landing there looking for indigenous life, that we don't find Earth life instead, right? So that's where that idea comes from. And the reason why it's important for this car is that the car will be passing the vicinity of Mars, and it will be kind of brushing actually up against the outer edge of the asteroid belt. It looks like it won't quite reach the asteroid belt perfectly, but it'll be kind of orbiting in between Earth at one end and then the edge of the asteroid belt at the other. So it's in this loop, this long looping orbit. They call it an elliptical orbit. And it'll be cycling around there with a period of, I think, a year or two. And it'll be doing that for a very long period of time. But the thing is that as it's moving in between the asteroid belt and Earth on this elliptical orbit, and when I say Earth, I mean the orbit of Earth, right? So we're thinking about not necessarily approaching the Earth, but just approaching the region where the Earth moves around the sun. It's going to be moved around by other planets. It's going to be tugged by planets and asteroids and it's going to be hit by sunlight. And all these effects, these very subtle effects, will gradually make its orbit change. And so over time, its orbit will evolve in ways we can't fully predict, chaotically. And that means that it could do something like fall onto Mars eventually, be captured by Mars and fall onto the Martian surface, and that could be a problem for looking for microbes in the future. I wouldn't worry about it too much, though. If you look at the math and the dynamics involved and you talk to the experts, they say that chances are the Starman and the Roadster will end up falling into the sun in a matter of a few million years.
Yeah, I think
but there's
right.
a chance. There's a chance, too, that it could be ejected from the solar system and go into interstellar space. It could potentially come and crash in the Pacific Ocean, too, on Earth. Lots of things could happen.
So it's kind of a random variable.
That's right.
And the idea of the planetary protection is you don't want to discover yourself when you go to Mars.
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
So when I was a kid in high school, this was back when everyone was always talking about cars and performance, and the Chevy guys, the guys that like Chevys, they would say that Ford stood for fix or repair daily. And the Ford guys would say first on race day. So I think that this was playing out across the world in all these different coffee shops and high schools, people talking about what's the fastest car out there. Well, end of story. This thing is going 12 kilometers per second. No one has to discuss what is the fastest commercial car. This car is
out there in space for sure. And of course, you know, it's not too bad off the race line down here on Earth either. You know, we can also extend, I think, to talking about rockets. People are thinking about the Falcon Heavy being the biggest and baddest rocket on the block. But we need to remember that there's lots of other rockets out there and lots of other rocket companies, and really the entire space transportation industry as a whole is changing profoundly due to the innovations from SpaceX and others. So there are people who, you know, the mainstays of aerospace industry like Boeing and Lockheed Martin. They're trying to catch up with SpaceX, and in some ways they're ahead. They're building other big heavy lift rockets too to try to compete with SpaceX here. They're trying to leverage their enormous decades of experience to make their existing rockets cheaper and easier to fly. They're also developing, Boeing, for instance, is developing a crew capsule for NASA that could take crews to and from the space station. That's something SpaceX is also doing. And then, of course, we have Amazon tycoon Jeff Bezos. His Blue Origin rocket company is developing another heavy lift booster called New Glenn that might also be competing with SpaceX soon. So there's a lot of rockets on the horizon, a lot of activity happening now that could really make the next couple of decades pretty wild in terms of space exploration and science.
The most exciting thing for me on Monday was that I think that this will continue to present viable commercial delivery systems into space for governments and corporations, that other people will get excited about this. And then secondarily, and this is something we're really big on here at Cool Science Radio, is encouraging STEM curriculums for kids and kids to be excited about taking STEM curriculums. And then, of course, the third thing is that it will inspire people around the world to not be afraid to work on big problems. I mean, there's a whole bunch of people in Silicon Valley that are working on flatulence apps for smartphones, and they need to get involved in bigger things. So that's what I'm excited about.
I think so. There's a lot to be excited about here. And of course, we are seeing a bit of an interesting pushback online. In social media is where you see it the most, where a lot of people are saying, hey, you know, why did SpaceX launch this vanity project? You know, why did it do this stunt where it's just launching Elon's car and this mannequin into space? Couldn't it have done something more useful? And I think that's a valid criticism. But we do need to remember, of course, that and the reason why people are bringing that up is for instance, the STEM inspiration you talked about. A lot of people are thinking, well, sure, a car in space is really cool, but are there other ways and better ways to inspire kids and get people involved in science and space exploration? And I think the answer is yes. But we have to remember also that this was a test flight, and most of the time you do need to have a test mass. You need to have something heavy on top of the rocket to make sure that it's performing like you think. Most people will just use concrete. They just put a bunch of concrete in the fairing at the top of the rocket, and they launch that. So that's kind of the alternative we were looking at here, and I think that we have to keep that in context when we look at this car. It is a wild, crazy stunt, but you know, if we put, for instance, a big, expensive space telescope on there, or you know, a Mars probe, there was a very good chance on Monday that this thing, or on Tuesday, this was just going to blow up. So the fact that it didn't is great, but if it had, then people would be very upset about that too. They'd say, "Oh, why do we put a telescope on there? Why do we put a probe? Why do we put little Timmy's science experiment that he sent into SpaceX? Why do we put that on there when it was just going to blow up?" So, you know, it's kind of the situation where the company maybe can't win, but I'm happy. I'm happy seeing the Starman drifting out there.
Hey, Lee. From my perspective, they won. Here we are. We're on the radio. We're talking about it. Right?
Yeah.
Anything to get a little bit more traction, a little bit more awareness. So my question to you, I mean, this is your beat. You're talking about this stuff. You're talking to Amazon, Lockheed, and all these other guys. Have they got an inkling? Do they have a department? Have they assigned an individual to come up with their quirky thing to try to increase the PR of their otherwise kind of wonky science project?
That's a really good question. And to my knowledge, no. But again, that's my knowledge is pretty limited here. And for instance, with Blue Origin, with Jeff Bezos' company, they are notoriously secret, very secretive. They tend not to reveal their plans too far in advance, and they play their cards very close to their vest. So they might have some amazing thing planned, but very few people know about it right now. And then you know the kind of more established players, folks like Boeing and Lockheed. You know, I just feel like it's maybe not in their corporate culture to do something like launching, you know, something so silly and fun and irreverent. You know, I think they almost take themselves a little more seriously than that, and I don't think that's a bad thing necessarily. I think that they're much more focused on delivering results and letting those results speak for themselves. You know, less sizzle, more steak. So there's, you know, we'll see though. We'll see what happens. Maybe this will kind of change the ball game here, where people are going to try to one up each other with wild stunts.
Yeah, seems like it worked to me.
So I respect the seriousness, and I love the fun part of it. And you know, so It's all good. We are speaking with Lee Billings, Space and Physics Editor at Scientific American. Lee, we will continue to follow your blog, and we thank you so much for joining us this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, John and Jack.
Okay, thank you. All right, folks, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, a quick, cool story, and then we're going to be talking with Dr. Compton Tucker, one of the chief scientists at NASA, not about space, we're going to be talking about dinosaurs. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Courtney Johansson, owner of 350 Main Brasserie, and we are pleased to support KPCW. 350 Main is newly renovated and located in the historic Golden Rule Building at 350 Main Street. We are open nightly at 5:30 p.m. and serve eclectic American cuisine. Reservations, menu, and contact information at 350main.com.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. We're going to do a quick, cool story before we speak with Dr. Compton Tucker from NASA. We're going to be talking to him about dinosaurs. There are some girls, ninth grade students, at Northern Jutland in Denmark, and they were sitting around working on different ideas for a biology project. And one girl said to the other, you know, I'm having difficulty concentrating in school. One of the other girls said, I am too. And then one of the girls said, you guys having trouble sleeping sometimes? And she says, yeah, we're having trouble sleeping. They found out that the one thing they all had in common is that they sleep with their smartphone next to their head on the bed table. And so this is what they basically did. The girls designed an experiment to investigate the impact of Wi-Fi radiation from a cell phone on themselves, on plants. And specifically, they chose cress seeds. They took a whole bunch of seeds. They put them in 12 different trays. Six of the trays, of the 12 trays, were placed in one room that did not have Wi-Fi. Six of the trays were put in another room where the exact, where Wi-Fi router was configured to provide the exact radiation that a cell phone would give. And after 12 days, they came and took a look at the seeds. The room where there was no Wi-Fi, the seeds were thriving. They were green. They were growing. Everything looked great. In the second room where the Wi-Fi was, some seeds never germinated. Some seeds that did germinate it shriveled. And then some seeds just turned brown and never got going in the first place. And I just think that that's fascinating.
Yeah, it looks like that experiment kind of opened their eyes to what might be happening by having a cell phone next to their bed at night. And not only is it an experiment that's well-received by the girls, but the word got out. You know, that's what you really want to have happen. And they got the attention of a scientist, Ole Johansson, who is a professor at the Karolinska Institute up in Stockholm. And he basically validated their experiment. And I'll read the quote here. The girls stayed within the scope of their knowledge, skillfully implemented and developed a very elegant experiment. The wealth of detail and accuracy is exemplary. Choosing Cress was a very intelligent choice, and I could go on. The girls did it right.
So Cool Science Radio salutes ninth grade girls at Northern Jutland in Denmark. And by the way, I'm in trouble. Not only do I sleep with a cell phone next to my bed, but I've got a Wi-Fi router under my bed because of the way things work in my house.
JW, that explains so much.
Okay. Our next guest, NASA scientist Dr. Compton Tucker. He brings us a unique story of dinosaur age meets space age, all on the property of NASA's Goddard Space Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. It's a simple story of Ray Stanford, a local dinosaur track expert, whose wife Sheila works at Goddard. Well, I don't want to give away the story, and we welcome Dr. Tucker from NASA to tell us what happened next. Dr. Tucker, welcome back
to
Cool Science Radio.
Nice to be here. What happened was in 2012, as you mentioned, Ray Stanford, who is the Mid-Atlantic authority on dinosaur tracks, he started off as an amateur paleontologist. He's self-taught, and he's now published several scientific papers on dinosaur tracks in the Mid-Atlantic region. So he's become an expert. He had joined his wife, who works at the Goddard Space Flight Center, for lunch. And after lunch, he dropped her off in her office. And as he was driving from the parking lot behind her building, he looked up and he saw the same type of sandstone in which we find dinosaur tracks. And he was curious, so he parked his car. He walked up to the sandstone, and lo and behold, there was a large Notosaur front footprint, which was a foot across. We had no idea that there would be other tracks there. And then to complicate things, a $35 million building was supposed to be constructed on that very site starting in the next week or two. So I was called by the building people, and they said, Tucker, we don't want to lose $35 million. I have experience in ground-penetrating radar surveys for archaeology. So my colleagues and I came over, and we surveyed the area. We found that the big Notosaur track was attached to a much larger section of sandstone, which was buried. So we got some volunteers from NASA who came in on weekends, and then we dug it up. And we had no idea there would be over 70 dinosaur and mammal tracks on it. That was subsequently revealed after we got it moved from the construction site.
That's fascinating. Dr. Tucker, this is Jack Rubin. Thanks for coming on this morning. Here on Cool Science Radio, we've done a number of stories about dinosaurs, and the more I hear about them, the more fascinating they are. We had a fellow on from Mercer University in southern New Jersey who said, gee whiz, this is like, you know, Dinosaur Central here. Southern New Jersey's got all kinds of tracks, and I'm from back there originally. And it sounds like, you know, dinosaurs were obviously in Maryland where you found them. The more I hear about dinosaurs, it sounds like they were everywhere. Is that reasonably accurate?
Yes, it is, because during the Cretaceous, the tracks we found were from about 110 million years ago in the Cretaceous period. The average global temperature was 80 degrees Fahrenheit. Sea level was 300 feet higher because there was no ice anywhere on the planet. And in New Jersey, as well as in Maryland, we had a tropical environment at that time. So it was warm, it was wet, and there were a lot of dinosaurs. What we found, which surprised us, was we have about at least 26 mammal tracks interspersed with dinosaur tracks on a slab of sandstone that's only about as large as your dining room table.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, you know, in reading more about your discovery, I think the other thing that was actually unbelievable about it is it was a snapshot in time. Is that right? Just sort of like one afternoon?
We think what happened, because there are no overtracks on our slab, and we published a paper a week ago in Scientific Reports on it, which is an open access journal if anyone is interested, if any of your listeners are interested to look at the journal article. What we found were no overtracks. I took part in some of the analysis on the slab, and I found no overtracks anywhere on it. So that means this was a snapshot in time, probably only a few hours. We think it might have been a tidal area, and when the tide comes in and goes out, it erases everything from the day before. All these dinosaurs and mammals were running around. It must have been the place to be on Saturday night, because we have more than 70 tracks there. And then there was some inundation event, a flood of silt or something like this, then covered everything and protected it from 110 million years ago to now.
I love the fact that back in December, I think it was December 14th, you and I were speaking about 20 years of Earth observations from multiple NASA satellites. And now we're talking about something that may have occurred 100 million years ago.
Yes.
And of course, dinosaurs are fascinating, but mammals with dinosaurs in the same series of tracks. I wanted to ask you a little bit about that. For an example, there are mammal tracks that occur in pairs representing hind feet, as if a squirrel-sized animal would sit there on its haunches. How big were these mammals?
Well, we have the largest mammal track so far from the Cretaceous, and it is a track that's about 5 or 6 inches long, and so that would be the size of a badger. Now, most of our tracks we have on the NASA slab are much smaller, and they're maybe 1 to 2 inches in size. So they're on the small size, but on small side, because these animals were small mammals. But we have to realize these were our ancestors. Now, what's also really interesting for all of us who have studied this, we have all these mammal tracks, and then we have four parallel trackways of carnivorous dinosaurs the size of a turkey or small dog, which are going in the same direction, and we think they were hunting the mammals.
So, yeah, that was lunch.
Yes, they were looking for lunch.
Yeah. So, you know, we've had a few stories here on Cool Science Radio about, asteroids hitting, various theories about dinosaur extinction, and the idea that little tiny mammals, who, as you say, were our ancestors, surviving. So this shows that there may have been more than just a simple shrew there that was serving as the fodder for the dinosaurs at that time.
Yes, we have this larger track of a mammal about the size of a badger.
Yeah. So I guess the question is, they or what you're proving is that they actually coexisted for a considerable period of time.
Yes.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Dr. Compton Tucker, who we typically talk to about the observation of our planet through a whole bunch of NASA satellites that they've been doing for the last 20, 21, 22 years. And today we're talking about dinosaur prints that have been discovered on the campus of Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, where Dr. Tucker is a leading scientist. Dr. Tucker, did you hear about the Mayan archaeology stuff that they uncovered with LIDAR in the last several days? So I wanted to ask you a question. First of all, for our listeners, LIDAR is short for light detection and ranging, and you'll find those are the things that sit on top of the autonomous cars that are spinning around like a little science fiction movie. But they was also used recently to identify the ruins of more than 60,000 houses, palaces, elevated highways, and other human-made features by being able to read through the canopy of deep jungle and be able to actually see these devices, or be able to see the topography of these Mayan villages. And I wanted to ask you, Dr. Tucker, is LIDAR a technology that is ever used in our satellites?
Yes, it is. It's used for mapping several things. Now, the frequency or the wavelength of the LIDARs you have described operate in the near-infrared,
right,
where there's no absorption by green leaves of that wavelength or that frequency of light.
Mm-hmm.
And so it penetrates through a dense canopy, like in a tropical rainforest or jungle, and then you can map the forest floor exactly as you described. And I found that report fascinating because it reveals what is beneath the tropical forest. Now, I've worked a lot in tropical forests, and I'm sure that I've walked by many places where there could have been buildings from a previous civilization, like in Central America, and you don't realize it because it's completely covered with plants and you can't see the actual topography of what's beneath it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we were fortunate that that Ray Stanford was able to see this rock where the footprints were, the dinosaur prints were. And I was curious, from space, is it possible, would it be possible to take a look through using LIDAR through vast stretches, if we knew what we were looking for, to be able to find remains of dinosaurs or dinosaur prints?
Probably not, because the scale is so small,
mm-hmm,
that you might be able to do this from a small footprint LIDAR in an airplane, which flies low and slow. That could be very useful for looking at dinosaur trackways, perhaps. But I'm afraid that the tracks are so small they would be obscured even from a low-flying airplane with a small footprint LIDAR.
Dr. Tucker, what's happened in the cafeteria at Goddard? You know, have people started looking down instead of looking up? I mean, is there some sort of cultural shift that you've been able to catalyze there?
Yes, well, that's a good question, because there are a bunch of us who had walked by the same area where Ray Stanford found this large nodosaur track. And when you look at it, it's very obvious it's a dinosaur track. But none of us had ever noticed it. So we were embarrassed by this. And now there are people bringing me rocks and also Ray Stanford rocks to look at. But most of them just clutter up my office.
That's interesting. That's interesting. You know, if you're going to look for one place for dinosaurs, to look at the Space Center wouldn't have been the most obvious choice.
No, it wouldn't. It surprised all of us. But we use what we found here with the dinosaurs and mammals from the Lower Cretaceous 110 million years ago to stress what NASA does do, and that is we have very advanced climate models, which we can run back to the Cretaceous period. And also NASA is looking for life on other planets from our space science people who study exobiology. So we use the dinosaur find here to segue and to illustrate what NASA is doing, looking for life on other planets. Possibly we could find a planet in the age of dinosaurs, probably pretty unlikely, but something like this could happen, and we all know fact is stranger than fiction.
Right.
Oh, that's for sure. Yeah. Dr. Tucker, since we last spoke, I mean, Goddard Space Flight, there are many different projects going on, but in your particular area of expertise, is there anything new you'd like to tell us about?
Well, we have lots of projects that are underway. We're very excited by we have several satellites that are about to go up, and next year we'll have a satellite or an instrument in space on the International Space Station, which will be a LIDAR instrument for mapping the world's forests. It's in a low inclination orbit, so it can only map from 51 north to 51 south latitudes. But we're very excited about having this LIDAR in space for forest mapping. And this is really cool, and it advances our understanding of forests, because now we can treat them in three dimensions instead of just two dimensions.
Well, that's fascinating. Dr. Compton Tucker, NASA Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
You're welcome.
Okay. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be speaking with Andy Hitchon, who's an engineer at Armada Skis. Stay with us.
This is Travis Vernon, fly fishing coordinator of JANS and longtime supporter of KPCW. Our fly fishing department and guide service is open year-round and offers a full line of flies and product, including brands like Sims, Sage, and Fishpond. We also rent rods, reels, and waders. Available at the flagship store on Park Avenue, 649-4949 or JANS.com.
Earl Matt Foot here from with San Nexus Francisco IT. Design, happy supporting our local radio station. Matt here from San Francisco Design, supporting our local radio station, KPCW. Since 1990, San Francisco Design offers interior design and a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings with store locations in Salt Lake City and Park City on Bonanza Drive. On the web at sanfrandesign.com, San Francisco Design, love your home.
Hi, this is Steve Roney Jr. from Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. We are a proud supporter of KPCW and our Park City community. Our agents are located in Summit and Wasatch counties, and we can be reached at bhhsutah.com or 649-7171.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Jack Rubin here with John Wells. Our final guest, final and best guest here today, in the studio with us is Andy Hitchon. He's an engineer at Armada Skis. If you've been a skier as long as I have, you know the evolution of skis and the materials used has been extensive. There's a lot of science that goes on. When skiing is marginal like it is now, we like to talk about it more. So we're invited a fellow today who understands what's going on with respect to designing skis and is from a leading ski boutique. Andy, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's skis have changed so much during, you know, I'm an old guy, so over my lifetime.
Sure.
And, you know, there are terms that get tossed around that you go into a ski shop and sometimes I feel like I'm not speaking the right language. You know,
sure.
People want to talk about side cut and rocker and materials and so forth. Could you just give us a little view is to, and by the way, I'm a huge fan of your skis. Right. I've got two Excellent. Pair. I love them. So I'm highly prejudiced. Sorry about that. But if you'd tell us a little bit about, how side cut and rocker sort of come into play and how you design skis.
Yeah, really, side cut and rocker are two of the first things we talk about when we are taking on a new project or working with athletes or defining a new ski. It's really the root of the ski, how it turns, is your side cut. I would look at side cut in a couple different ways, and one is the radius. What is the number? Sometimes it's 16 meters, sometimes it's 30 meters, really depending on the style of ski. And what we're trying to do here is determine the shape that the ski is going to make on the snow. So in a low snow year like this, looking out the window, seeing people skiing under the chairlift, they're on harder packed snow, narrower runs. There's probably a better side cut for that condition than, say, Alaska in April when the snow is deep.
Right.
So working with, if we're designing a new powder ski, it's a very different demand of side cut than, say, an all-mountain on-piste ski that we would sell here in town. One of our typical shapes, for example, would have like an 18-meter side cut. That's very easy to get off the gondola, get off the chairlift, and make nice turns on a normal run. When we work with athletes that are going a lot faster, a lot steeper conditions, maybe a little bit more variable conditions, we might lengthen that radius.
Right. So just to back up for guys that are less technically oriented, we all talk about the parabolic ski.
Sure.
So the side cut is how parabolic it is?
The side cut is, you could also call side cut side camber. And that's kind of when you measure the tip and the tail, how far in does the side of the ski dive inward to make kind of the waist of the ski?
Right.
That would be the side cut, part of the parabolic equation, yes.
Andy, I was intrigued by the original OC business plan, which said Armada, what skiing will become. Tell us how you differentiate yourself from the pack.
Yeah, I think that type of slogan or that type of mentality from the beginning was working with athletes to give them the equipment that they couldn't get at the time. So if it was a ski that had a very strange side cut, go back in time to Armada's ARG, this ski had a reverse side cut. This was a pure powder device that no other brand was offering. So athletes had a need for this type of performance. Athletes had a goal of skiing in mind, and Armada was really the only company that would provide that equipment for them. So while these athletes are looking forward as to what they want to ski like, Armada was the one offering them the equipment to do this. And we still do that today. Our athletes are our number one focus when we're developing a new product.
Okay.
So reverse side cut. So that would be sort of bulging underfoot as opposed to...
Wider underfoot and narrower in the tip and tail.
That would be a conversation starter.
A bit of a strange one on a hard packed day like today outside, but in deep snow, in the trees, in Alaska, these guys loved it.
Right.
There are still people scouring eBay for these things.
That's right.
It's a crazy ski that doesn't work every day, but when it does work, it's amazing.
So talk to us a little bit about camber and rocker.
So rocker and camber are, the bottom, the profile of the ski with respect to the snow. How high is the tip off the snow or the center of the ski? And we really kind of change these to dictate how a ski works in powder or maybe on hill, on piece performance. If you've got a guy that's skiing half pipe, we're going to give that ski no tip and tail rocker and a lot of camber underfoot. So he's got a lot of power going into the walls, a lot of grip on the ice. The inverse of that would be a powder ski. We'd like to raise the tip and the tail to make it a little bit more loose, a little bit more forgiving, float better, a little bit more maneuverable. And then in the middle of that is, say, a 95 waist all mountain ski. We might give it a little bit of tip rocker so it's easy to get into a turn, but it's not overly... affecting the turn radius. It's not reducing the performance of the ski.
So I've got a pair of Invictus that I really like. Great. And I was talking to another guy who had a pair, and we both said, gee whiz, these are great skis. And somehow we both came at the same time and said, yeah, but no back seat. if you don't stay over the tip, yep, you're going to be in trouble. So how's that work?
That's a comment we do hear a lot when we're testing, and I think that comes from having a high performance threshold. If the ski is going to be good at speed, nice and stable, often they are a lot of work. We tailor our skis and our side cuts and our rockers and the materials kind of for the intended purpose of, if you're going to be skiing fast and hard charging, keep it glued to the snow, it's going to be hard to work. It's going to be hard work to keep the thing moving. If we make it really lightweight and effortless to move side to side, you can get in the back seat, you can get out of position and the ski will still support you. But for our higher performance skis, they'll definitely work you. If you get into the wrong position, they can be tough.
Yeah, it's a good good little keep you straight kind of thing.
That's right.
So the last time we had you on the show, Andy, you all were privately held and doing your thing here in Park City. And then recently, about 10 months ago, you were acquired by Amer Sports, if I pronounce that correctly, and you joined Salomon and Atomic in their lineup. Tell us what is different. Are you still able to pursue your own designs, to keep your own model lines going? Tell us what's different since the acquisition.
Yeah, so for those people living in Park City, you've probably noticed we're no longer on the building out in Jeremy Ranch. We have moved down to Prospector. So we're a lot closer to town, closer to restaurants, closer to kind of the downtown atmosphere of Park City. Amer has, for the most part, left us alone. It's been a great acquisition. We've worked with Amer for years in manufacturing. We've always had, you know, maybe a third or half of our skis made there. So now working with their engineers, working with their team as an owned brand, it allows us a lot more flexibility in our design and as much freedom as we had before. We're really not regimented to design the same skis as a Salomon or Atomic. We're all unique brands, and the brands are held very separate from each other. So we've got a lot of freedom. We still do all the ski design right here in Park City. A lot of the testing goes on here. A lot of our athletes live here. Our European office remains the same. So, no, it's been a great combination, you know, a great team together now. And I'd say we have as much flexibility as ever.
Good. You know, my mind's still kind of spinning at the idea of reverse side cut. great to have an opportunity to speak with you. What can I tell my buddies on the chairlift next time I head out about new stuff you guys might be working on that you might be willing to talk about?
You know, one thing we've been playing with a lot, skis that just released this year, it's this Tracer family, and it's kind of a modernization or another design iteration on Invictus, and we've implemented a lot of these five-axis CNC machines, a lot of technical manufacturing, a lot of big, expensive processes that we're using to make these things. You know, it's new materials, it's new shapes. It allows us to use these expensive machines at now our factory to make kind of cutting-edge product. Mm-hmm. So I would say, you know, tell your friends to look at our, you know, go out and get on the new skis, try them. They are very different than Invictus, and intentionally so. We try and make two different model lines here for the freeride guy. But, you know, we're able to save weight. We're able to make the ski super strong on edge. But maybe what you felt in your Invictus of not being able to get in the back seat or getting out of position is easier on these skis. Okay. Maybe we didn't reduce the performance threshold a lot, but we've made them more versatile, more forgiving.
And this year, I don't know that anybody's out shopping for powder skis, but your JJs have always been a favorite. And coming from the east to the west, you know, it's like, gee whiz, you know, if you're going to be going to join the big leagues, you got to get some big fat skis. Is there anything going on in powder skis that would be worth talking about?
Yeah, and powder skis, I mean, for the most part, we're shipping these all to the northwest right now. It seems like that's where the snow is. This is where our athletes have all kind of traveled to. We're continuing to innovate in kind of the, you know, the fat ski, big tip and tail rocker. We've got a new ski with this ARV 116. It's kind of the replacement of the JJ. A little bit more stable and solid than the old JJ was. So you lose a little bit of that forgiveness, but I think you pick up a little bit more performance in the crud, in the steeps. Another super fun ski with a lot of rocker, a lot of shape to the side cut, really nice, playful ski. But we're continuing to push our powder development. You know, in Europe this year, there's a lot of snow. And our office over there is going crazy, testing our new products and working hard to get out on these things.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Andy Hitchon. He's an engineer at Armada Skis. And I heard recently that there's at least one manufacturer that's starting to work and provide a waxless type ski. They have materials that don't wear out. And is that something you're looking at?
Yeah, it's a really cool concept. The thought of having a nicely waxed, more of a slippery ski, right? If you jump on a ski that's been nicely waxed, you can feel it easier from edge to edge. Maybe it's more consistent throughout the day. I think if we had a really revolutionary waxless system like this that made the ski, you know, ski like a freshly tuned pair every day, we would be all over this. We've been working with raw material manufacturers, chemical engineers, chemistry companies to try and create a base material like this. So I haven't skied these skis yet, but I am very interested to and to learn more about the science behind it, because I think it could be very interesting.
If you're used to getting your skis tuned at the beginning of the season, you can get about halfway, maybe three quarters through the season, and you say, geez, they're not performing the way they used to.
Sure. And, you know, we we tune our skis a lot, I guess, as we're out on them every, you know, every couple of days and trying out new products. So we're just kind of used to this. But no, it's a really interesting concept. I think it's worth digging into further.
Okay.
Are there any new materials, you know, graphene, prepreg carbon fiber? You know, you hear all the stuff, sounds like it should be in the SpaceX as opposed to the skis. But what are you working with these days?
Yeah, so one of the materials we introduced last year, we coined the term crystal mesh. It's a highly crystalline plus minus 45 degree weave of a material called Enegra. And this is a vibration dampening polypropylene, basically. And so we're placing this under the ski surface. We would use metal in the past to filter vibrations. But we found that this Enegra, our crystal mesh, does a very good job of filtering out the vibrations, keeping your ski more quiet, glued to the snow without adding any extra weight.
So skiing on a milk bottle.
A very highly processed one.
Right.
Yes.
Basically
but,
the same material.
Or polypropylene.
But there's certainly a softness to polypropylene.
Yeah.
Sure, which is a vibration dampener.
Yeah.
So in our application, you know, the skis introduce to vibrations through the snow or through the edges, and this material quiets that.
Right.
So you'll find it in stand-up paddle boards, carbon fiber mountain bikes. It's definitely getting out into the composite
world.
Does
it reduce chatter?
Reduces chatter and keeps the ski, you know, less chattery, more glued to the snow.
Right. Yeah. I you know, I get on your skis and you know, stuff with the big camera, and it's like a snow tire.
Yeah. The goal is to grip the snow as hard as possible, so that when you're making turns, you're not coming loose. You feel very well supported. But you also don't want a tank under your feet. You don't want the heaviest ski possible. Those are super stable, but they're too heavy. Mm-hmm. They're too tiring. So an innovative material like this Enegra comes along, and it weighs almost nothing. It filters out vibrations, and it's a real perceived value. You know, we can feel it in the skis we test it in.
Anything else new you want to tell us about?
Oh, we're just, you know, right now we're in the middle of testing 1920 product. We've kind of released to the shops all of next year's equipment. We're working on that and working hard on the new 2 years away stuff. So
hopefully 2020.
2020.
Right. Okay.
Yes, exactly. The winter of 1920, 2 years ago.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Andy Hitchon, who, of course, is with Armada Skis as an engineer. Thanks so much for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you guys for having me.
Okay. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we may have time for another cool story. Stay with us.
Hi, this is Shelley Barris, Executive Director of Habitat for Humanity. Have you been to our ReStore lately? You will find treasures every visit because we receive new donations of furniture, appliances, and building materials daily. Even better, your purchases support local hardworking families. We are a nonprofit and proud to be a KPCW supporter.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, fredmarshallpainting.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. We want to thank our sponsor, San Francisco Designs, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Nexus IT, Habitat for Humanity ReStore, Natural History Museum of Utah, and Park City Mountain. This, of course, is KPCW in Park City. Jack, do we have time for another cool story?
I think we've got a quick one here. One I saw recently, which fascinated me because it afflicted me as a kid, was motion sickness. And is there a technological solution to it? And apparently there is. And you can't solve something until you know what the problem is. So yeah, you probably have done this with your kids. You give them something to read in the backseat of the car, and uh-oh, watch out. You don't want to do that. And it turns out that the theory is, in reading, your eye tells you that you're stable and you're still, but your inner ear is in the car getting jiggled around. So your brain is getting two different inputs. One is stable, one is motion, and your brain doesn't know what to do with it. And the theory is that it thinks that you've probably eaten something that's causing you to perhaps hallucinate because you've gotten inputs that are in conflict. And what do you do to protect yourself? You get rid of it. Not good for parents in a backseat.
Throwing
car.
Up. Yeah.
Yes, thank you. That's a better way to describe it, JW. So the solution is to put some LED lights in the car that you can see from the periphery of your sight line. So you might be able to read, but here are these lights kind of moving around that help you coordinate the input from your eye and the input from your middle ear. So you're able to read, be in a car, and not have an upset stomach. So if technology can solve that problem, there's hope for us all.
So maybe put these lights in reading glasses or something like that. So breaking away from the autonomous car and just thinking about people that get motion sickness, are there other ways to do this?
Yeah. So it could be in the cell of the car, you know, or the whatever capsule you're in, a boat, airplane, whatever, on the you know, the stanchions of the cockpit, or it could be in your glasses.
Okay. Well, thank you, and also thank you for joining us this morning. NPR National News is next. Everybody get outside. It's going to be a beautiful day. Don't spend so much time looking at your smartphone. Look up in the sky. It's